thank you for coming to our conversation today by Terry Soares of Soares Nursery about new gardening practices. She wants this to be a conversation, so we're going to talk back and forth and ask questions and such. We had intended to honor Susan Witzel, our archivist, who just retired, and she was going to be here taping this, but she's got a cold and she's at home. So anyway, we do have some cookies and seltzer in the next room after we're talking.
Great.
Anyway, so nice to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me today. I was excited about that this was a conversation. I do PowerPoint presentations, but I'm tired of gadgets and email and everything else, so I thought, this is great. We'll just have a nice talk. And feel free to jump in any time with any questions that you might have. We haven't had much of a winter this year, which has been awesome, so I'll be talking later on about jumping into spring cleanup. But I wanted to start with the Church of the Messiah landscape. So I was the building project manager for the Church of the Messiah. I've been going there for almost 40 years. I was married there, my kids were baptized there, so I felt just this real connection as we made this decision to take this old building that was falling apart and repurpose the building for the next century. And it was an amazing project to be involved with. And how many of you had been inside the old before the renovation? So it was like grandma's attic. It was dark and just kind of gloomy. And the upstairs had offices with dropped ceilings. And it was just really ugly. So when we started the building project and they stripped everything down to the studs and they took out the drop ceiling upstairs and revealed this beautiful cathedral ceiling that had originally been there. I mean, if you haven't had a chance, just please stop by in there and take a look at it. It turned out really beautiful. But before we did anything there, we knew we needed to address the magnificent beech trees that are between the new parish community center and the stone church. There were three of them. They were, we figured they were about 125 years old already. So we brought an arborist in and determined that because of where we had to put our septic system and the proximity of the trees, that two of them were gonna have to go. That was probably one of the hardest decisions we made on that project. So we removed the two weaker ones. We left the bigger one, the more vigorous one. And during construction, we had a 10-foot fence put around the tree to protect the root mass. And I think we did a good job. You didn't really miss the trees once they were gone because the two that were removed were really spindly. They were actually planted too close together. Beeches are a tree that you plant for posterity. And you know, when you're planting, something to think about when you're planting trees now, you know, you put this tree in the ground, well, think 20, 50 years down the road how big that tree might get. So we really tried to practice what we preach, no pun intended, about sustainability. Reverend Warner is really big on the environment and we wanted to have a landscape that was sustainable. So we did a very limited lawn area, very few foundation plantings. There's just a little strip of decorative hydrangeas going up the front walkway. But as you face the building, sloping down to the steamship parking lot was a really challenging sight, and we wanted that to be sustainable. So we used a no-mow fescue. So if you're not familiar with some of the different kinds of grasses, most lawns that we have are Kentucky bluegrass. Heavy feeders, they constantly need fertilization and watering. So the no-mow fescues, you know, it's not going to look like a golf course, but it grows very slow and short. So this grass will probably get about 4 to 6 inches high. It was not meant to be mowed because we knew we couldn't mow on that really steep slope. We also added along the base of the big stone wall that retains our parking lot. We just planted natives. We used inkberry. Inkberry for conservation plantings is a great evergreen shrub, black berries, so it provides a food source for the birds in the wintertime and also shelter. We used clethra, which is a sweet pepper bush or summer sweet, extremely fragrant, blooms in July and August. The straight native species is white and kind of lanky looking, and that is the shrub that ConCom wants you to use. They don't want you to use varieties of things. Arlene knows this well. but the varieties, if you're not, have the ConCom over your shoulder, there's hummingbird, which only gets about 3.5 feet tall, and then there's ruby spice, which has pink flowers to it, but we wanted to go with the straight native species, so we went with the clethra. We also used bayberry on the slope, and none of these shrubs will need to be pruned. They were all planted 6 or 7, sometimes 12 to a mass, so that they were all meant to just kind of grow together. And then we planted 5 river birch trees along the slope. And the nice thing about birches is they're one of the first trees to bloom, flower in the spring, so they're a great pollinator source for in the early spring for bees especially. We do have irrigation, but it's very limited as to how we use it. We used a seed lawn instead in the flat area. We did use a seed lawn. It's called a Cape Cod grass seed mix. So it's kind of a tough lawn. It's not going to look like a golf course. But once the lawn is established, we'll be able to cut back the irrigation to maybe 2-3 days a week. And I think people over-irrigate their lawns. They have them come on every day. It's not necessary. But to achieve that that end goal of not having to irrigate the lawn so much, we used 8 inches of loam in the lawn areas. So that is the key. You know, if you're establishing a new lawn area, the more loam, the better. You know, if you put in 2 inches of loam on top of our brown sand, you're just not going to grow a good lawn. Therefore, you have to add more fertilizer and you have to irrigate it more. So the loam is the key to a good lawn. And then we do have drip irrigation on the few ornamental plantings that we do have. But again, once those shrubs are established, we might have the drips come on once a week, if that. We might, down the road, we'll probably only have to have the drips come on during drought. And so again, people install these drip irrigation systems and have them come on every day. And what happens is the roots, instead of going down to seek water and having a nice deep root system, they all stay on the top. So when it does dry out, they really can't handle a drought situation well. We're also encouraging moss as a lawn substitute under the beech because we didn't want to mow around the beech roots. And I personally love moss gardens and moss lawns. I think they're beautiful. So we were able to limit the fertilization and the 8 inches of loam that we use on the church. So that landscape will be 1 year old in May, and we're really pleased how it's already filling out. So again, if you have a chance to go by and see the inside of the new building, we're very proud of it. So I did want to talk about sustainability in gardening. We are really starting to rethink the American garden, and I don't know where you are on climate change. Having worked in this business for almost 40 years, I can see the changes happening to our climate. I see more erratic weather patterns. I see trees blooming and flowering earlier at different times than even 15 years ago. We're seeing plants, invasive species that are consuming our native areas. And we're also, the most worrisome is new insect species starting to invade areas. The newest one that that we're learning about is called the spotted lanternfly. And it looks like, you know, a brown moth with orange big dots on either side of the wing. And I encourage you to Google that. We're going to have information at the nursery so that people can identify these insects. It's so worrisome that if you see it, you're asked to report it to the mass ag stations. Our oak and maple forests are literally at risk with this insect. So it's kind of scary, you know, what's happening out there. But I think the more we're all aware of what climate is doing to the yards, we can all garden a little bit more responsibly. So think of it as kind of rewilding the gardens. You know, we're so used to these very clipped, manicured, every leaf removed from the yard. And I do get that, you know, especially with the summer homes here, and you want everything to look beautiful. So it's hard to sort of wean people off of that idea that everything has to be so neat and tidy. And a couple of years ago, I went to a lecture and was introduced to the idea of zone gardening. So the idea is to, it really referred to irrigation, but I started to apply that practice to landscape design and encouraging clients to think this way too. So zone one would be around the house, your front lawn, the walkway leading up to whatever door most people use to get into your house. So those are the areas that you, yes, you would irrigate, you would fertilize responsibly, you would mulch and irrigate as well. But so that's just around your immediate house. Then you get into zone two. So that might be an outer area, like a rough lawn where kids can play on. Maybe you have shrub beds out there. So maybe the irrigation comes on once a week or just during a drought situation. And you leave the leaves in the beds and not clean up every single one and use the leaves as a natural mulch. And then you get to zone three, which is just let nature take its course, you know, the outer edges of your lawn. So don't feel like you have to clean up every single leaf out of your yard. It's actually, I've seen properties that every year, I'm thinking sport, you know, they just cleaned up every single leaf on the property. Well, over time, the soil is hard. It's not draining. Things aren't thriving as much. About 3 years ago, I started practicing what I preach, and I let the leaves stay in my beds at the house. And I will tell you, it was hard. You know, it was like, okay, I'm going to leave all these leaves here. And I did clean up around my back patio, the front door, you know, around the house. But after 2 or 3 years, my hostas doubled in size. The shrubs were thriving. I didn't have to water. So after 3 years, you know, I'd already built up like a 4 to 6 inch layer of leaf mulch, which is much more porous and drainable than bark mulch. I think we all use way too much bark. I'm really trying to encourage people, if they want mulch in front of their houses, mulch every other year and try to find a mulch that's double ground or maybe not quite so woody, because as that those woody chunks decompose, they take nitrogen from the soil and thus nitrogen from your plants. Please don't use the orange hemlock mulch. I just think it's hideous. It's a dye. It doesn't look good with anything. I won't put it down. Yeah.
How about the black mark? Is it carbonate?
I was just gonna mention that. That's like, it's funny how things go in waves. That's the new hot mulch, is this black bark mulch. And if you've ever used it and spread it, I mean, you get filthy. It's all over you. So I asked Blacksmith Shop Farm, I said, what do they use to make this? Well, they use charcoal. It's carbon, which isn't bad, but I find that they use that to color really poor quality mulch. You know, you might be thinking you're getting tree bark mulch when in fact you're getting ground up telephone poles, pallets. So if you can find a mulch that's been double ground, that helps as well because it's fine pieces and it helps to decompose faster. And the other thing, we call them mulch volcanoes, where, you know, you have a tree and they pile up the mulch up the trunk of the tree. And that is like the worst thing you can do because all the air exchange and the water exchange and nutrients happens around that foot, around where the trunk is. So if you have mulch volcanoes in your yard, just pull them away. And you'll see all these little fine roots have started to grow in that mulch. So in the long run, it really is a detriment to your plant health. Coming from the South, we used pine needles for mulch. And I still, it's hands down, it's my favorite mulch. It's once you start building it up, you really just have to sprinkle it on top. So most of my beds now have like a 4 to 6 inch layer of pine needles. I also, in the fall, when the leaves start falling, we mow the lawn, bag it up, and those ground up leaves can also be used as mulch. So again, I use pine needles around my house, but you could certainly do the ground up leaves in your zone 2 or 3 areas and have the finer looking mulch up against your house. The other thing is we're rethinking our front yards. Less lawn and more beds for habitat. So if you've got huge expanses of lawn, you know, think about carving out beds and planting pollinator shrubs or groups of shrubs in the lawn that are much less hungry and thirsty for fertilizer and water than a lawn would be. And it creates pockets of habitats for wild animals. So instead of grass, the Kentucky blue is sort of the standard. That's what sod is grown from. Sod farms, it takes 3 years to grow sod to be harvested. And if you use sod, you have to have irrigation and you have to do the 5-step fertilization program because it just won't last. Even with 6 to 8 inches of mulch, or excuse me, of loam, it's just such an artificial way to grow grass. You know, I understand new construction, you just want it done, but you know, just be aware that in the long run, sod is not going to hold up in a drought situation like a seed lawn would. Yeah,
isn't the ryegrass used as lawn?
So ryegrass is used in seed mixes because it sprouts really quick. So it especially in areas for erosion, it will help hold that soil in place until the Kentucky bluegrass or the fescues can take over. Kentucky blue also needs full sun. It will take some shade, but it really doesn't thrive in the shade. There is a seed mix called Black Beauty, which is a mixture of fescues, which do tolerate shade, and fescues, it's a thinner leaf, and it grows shorter. So it's a different look, but I think it's fine. So Black Beauty if you have lawn in shady areas. I mentioned mosses. We guest hosted CL's radio show a couple of weeks ago, and this woman called in, "Oh, I've got moss in my yard. How do I get rid of it?" I'm like, "Well, we like moss." But if you see moss, that's an indication that it's poor drainage. There's not enough sun. You haven't lined your yard. So if you think you're just going to spread moss killer and it's going to go away, it's like treating the symptoms. You have to address the cause of why you have moss. But I think moss lawns are just beautiful.
Can you speak about Lyme? Is that automatic?
Yes. So again, Kentucky bluegrass, even the fescues, but especially Kentucky bluegrass. Our soils here on the Cape are very acidic, and lawns like alkaline soil. So if you haven't lined your yard in a number of years and your lawn is not doing great, you might want to add some lime. Fall is best, but you can do it now. It just takes a little bit longer to break down and the grass to absorb that. We've also been using a lot of our native grasses. So the native grasses, they're short ones called sedges. Our native grasses would never be like a lawn area where the kids could go out and play ball or play games on it. But sedges grow from like 2 to 4 inches to about 6 inches. And they're like little tufts of grass. So, you know, if you have outer areas that you don't need to have foot traffic on, the sedges work great in there. And then I love our native panicum or switch grasses. They do get up about 3.5 to 4 feet tall, but tough as nails once they're established. They add movement to the garden, great pollinator plants. So consider some of the native grasses. I've actually gotten away from using some of the ornamental grasses, like the miscanthus, the maidenhair grasses, which are the big vase-shaped ones with the giant plumes. They're wonderful in the right place, but if you've ever tried to dig one out that's established, you need a bobcat. I mean, they're really tough to get out. So as little like exclamation points in the garden, those are fine. But we're using less and less of those kinds of grasses and leaning more towards our native grasses. Water usage is, I think, the single biggest thing that we can do to help with sustainable gardens. We should not be watering lawns with drinking water. I just think it's a sin. It's just a waste of water and a resource that we really need to start protecting. So that all comes back to good soil preparation so that, you know, your plants are establishing themselves in good loam and mulching, so you're not losing water to evaporation. There is a movement now. You know, it's funny how, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and all these things that you did for years and years and years, now they say, oh, that's no good. It's like butter. You know, oh, you can't eat butter anymore. Now they're telling you to eat butter. So with the I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. I was thinking about So we need to rethink, you know, how we're using water in the landscape. The other big thing that we've been thrilled to be a part of at the nursery and have been so excited about how people have embraced this is using pollinators or planting for pollinators. 2 or 3 years ago, we became a way station, a monarch station at the nursery. And Diane Miller is our monarch queen at the nursery. And she had us all carrying around chrysalis and eggs and feeding them milkweed. And, you know, to watch that whole process of this butterfly that started literally as a size of a period on a piece of paper, and it looked like a little green jewel to this chrysalis, and then to watch the monarchs emerge was just amazing. So we figured we've done our part at the nursery to help the monarch population. And we're also growing plants that you might not have thought of before that are ornamental, but also host and nectar plants for our pollinators. That's something I learned from Diane. I just thought, oh, milkweed, you know, but no, that's a host plant for the monarchs. So by planting a variety of different plants, you can have a food source for pollinators from Now with the crocuses are one of the first things that are coming up, and you see them on a sunny day and they are just covered with bees all the way to the fall with sedums and asters. One of our helpers at the nursery, Marty, she has 7 beehives that we let her have at the nursery. And she says it's that early spring and late fall that is the most challenging time for the bee population because there's not as many food sources. So the we've been, whatever asters we have left over at the end of the season, we're just planting them all around the fields at the nursery so that the bees could have a food source. Mulching. We touched on that a little bit. Again, the bark mulch, I think less is more. Once you build up 3 or 4 inches, you don't need to add that 3 or 4 inches every year. And I think a lot of the more commercial landscapers, you know, they, oh, well, we did 4 yards at Mrs. Smith's last year, let's just do 4 yards again. And you don't really need that. It's actually a detriment to have too much bark mulch in your bed. So every other year, and fluff it up a little. And my way of planting is to plant so close that, you know, once everything fills in, there's no room for weeds, you know, maybe along the edges. But, it, you know, again, it's about rethinking how we're approaching our gardens. And that gets back to rethinking our fall cleanup. You know, we don't need to rake out every single leaf from the yard. And I think you'll see the difference in your soil if you start letting the leaves accumulate. And once you get out of that mindset that everything has to be neat and perfect, you'll see the benefits that it does to your yard. Fertilizing. That's where I lost my train of thought. The soil amendments. That's why I write everything down. So fertilizing. Years ago, everybody was like, oh, you're planting a tree or shrub, you need to add a bag of compost to it. So now the new way of thinking is that you want to plant the plants in existing soil so they adapt to the site. And if you notice, like in a pot-bound plant that you buy from the nursery, once the roots, you know, hit that pot edge, they just start growing around in circles. So especially if you have like clay soil, the theory was that that same thing was going to happen. The roots would get to the edge of that hole that you dug, and then they're just going to start growing in circles. Well, I think that's true if you have very heavy clay soil, but we basically have brown sand on the Cape, and you cannot plant an azalea or a rose that needs that extra rich soil and expect it to thrive. So what we do is we dig the hole for whatever we're planting, take that soil, put it off to the side, and then mix it with lobster compost, and peat, and then use that as a backfill. So they get a little extra boost from the compost, but they're adapting with the existing soil there. I'll never give up my lobster or my cow manure, especially here on the Cape. We're also doing things like bee hotels, which really are can be quite attractive. To me, they sometimes can look like garden art. They look like little bamboo poles that have been cut into pieces and inserted to look like little houses or in rings. So like mason bees, which are another great pollinator and a native bee, they can go into their little hotels and they've got a place to lay their eggs. We're telling
where do you put them?
You just hang them up like on a tree. Oh. I don't put them right around the garden because they do attract bees. Although, I think I've been stung 2 times in my whole life, and I'm outside. I mean, I'm literally like pushing the bees aside. I think they know if you, and I've learned this from Marty, if you just move slowly and just kind of brush them away, you know, they, just these are bees, not wasps. Wasps tend to be, and yellow can be very aggressive, especially in the fall. So we've learned that.
I read that mason bees don't sting.
Oh. Another plus.
And the other thing is,
I've only seen mason bee houses in catalogs. Is there any way you can just buy them?
Yeah, we sell them at the nursery.
Good.
Yes. In fact, that was a workshop we were thinking of having later in the fall, because I think they would be fun to make.
Okay. Out of what?
Usually bamboo, hollowed stakes, and then you just cut them into pieces. They only need to be about maybe 6 inches long. And then you just have even just a metal ring, and you insert them in the metal ring, and then
that'd
you
be fun.
Just to add to it, I took out one of the two-day field programs at Wellfleet Audubon a couple of years ago with Gail Trenholm from Canada, and it was on pollinators. And as part of our three days, we built a bee hotel, but a pretty big one. And having a frame and then using some PVC pipes. And within those PVC pipes, we were cutting Phragmites stems because they're sacred.
Yeah.
And so it's a great use of Phragmites to help clear.
Oh, what a great idea.
And I took a picture of one that I saw in the Tuileries in Paris.
Yeah.
It is the most gorgeous hotel I've ever seen.
Yeah.
So I'd be happy to share that with you. And if you could get a workshop, that would be
Pinterest is really dangerous. I see all these things on Pinterest. So if you go on Pinterest and search for bee hotels, I mean, they're works of art. They're absolutely beautiful in the garden. And another thing we're telling people to do, you know, your brush piles, your log piles. Well, those are actually great habitats for animals. So I don't put them next to the house. They're sort of at the edges of the woods, but all the voles and the snakes and the chipmunks, they all kind of go out that way. But if I see a snake in my garden, I'm thrilled because I know that they're going to take care of the voles and the chipmunks that eat everything else in the yard. So things that I think we just need to get away from that idea that everything needs to be pristine in our yards. So any questions on sustainability?
When you say you bulk with pine needles, do you use white pine needles or
anything,
Japanese black pine?
Anything, yeah. When we do the fall cleanups, we separate the pine needles, and that's my reward at the end of the day. I get my own pile of pine needles.
I've heard that the Portuguese were so successful, but they used white pine needles on the stronger.
Oh, interesting. My husband's family his family grew up on Davisville Road, and that was all the farm area. So when I first moved up here from Fairfax, Virginia, any of you that know Virginia, it is like red brick clay. We moved to an apartment on Davisville, and I see why that was the strawberry king there. You could literally dig 3 feet, and it was nothing but the best loam I had ever gardened in. So then we moved from there, built our house in Hatchville, and, you know, I'm just used to sticking stuff in the ground on Davisville. We get out to Hatchville, and it's literally this much, you know, brown sand, and the rest was sand. So because I mulch with leaves and pine needles, now all my beds are almost a foot to 2 feet of compost that I'm planting in now.
Can you speak more about fertilizer? Obviously, I'm a newbie to this, so I know, okay, forget the commercial companies, but is there, I mean, I know the organic stuff is problematic. What are you recommending?
We use plant tone. So it's any of the tone products, they're listed as organic, they're granular. So I don't like to fertilize things in the ground with the blue stuff, you know, Miracle-Gro, Jax. They're great for container gardens and your annuals because those do need a lot of food to produce those flowers like you see in the catalogs. But the granular fertilizers, they stay longer in the ground. They don't break down so quickly. So I think it's... especially if you've just planted something like in the last 2 or 3 years, I do like to give them a feeding in the spring. I like to wait until mid to late April, and I'll speak about this when I talk about hydrangeas. But if you fertilize too early and we get warm days and it's pushing out that tender new growth, and then we get those freezes that we've had in late April, you're going to kill back all those buds and the tender growth. So just hold off on the fertilizing for
right now. I'm putting grass and fertilizing.
A lawn's, when the forsythia is blooming, is the time to do the first lawn application with crabgrass control. We fertilize our own lawn, but the crabgrass control, the rest are just straight feedings. Unless I'm having a specific insect or weed problem, I don't like to just generally do the weed and feeds. But the crabgrass control is weather sensitive, so that's your
forsythia,
cue. When the forsythia is blooming, that's when you can start fertilizing.
Is there a brand? Are you just
Scott's and any of them.
See.
Yeah.
But then again, fertilizer for the lawn, you're saying you don't.
That one time, you know, that's the most, if you only want to fertilize your lawn one time in the season, that's the most important one, is that fertilizer with crabgrass.
Oh, I see,
control.
With the crabgrass.
So
okay.
The lawn companies, we call them the five-step programs.
Yes.
You know, it's way too much, unless it's a new seed lawn that you're trying to establish. But after the second year, you know, you can cut down from five applications to certainly three. So the early spring when the forsythia is blooming, a midsummer one, and then the fall with lime.
So you don't have a problem with those companies using that if you cut back the quantity?
Oh, you can tell them what you want.
Yeah, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're always
yeah.
going to try and cause
sure.
to tell you, oh,
but
no,
I
you
mean
need the five step.
The content of it, you don't have a problem.
No,
okay.
You can use organic,
yeah, we
can but it's,
that.
You know, I guess it's your level of, you know, what you want your lawn to look like. I mean, we have clients, they want it to look like a golf course, so they need heavier feeding. But for regular use, you know, we just do ours three times a year.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you leave the leaves, don't do a full fall cleanup. What happens in the spring? Do you rake them up then or summer? How do you know what to do then?
So in the fall, we let them all come down. I do get the leaves off the lawn because if you leave the leaves on the lawn, you're going to kill patches of it. So we mow up what's on the lawn, and as the perennials in my beds get hit by frost and we cut them down, I'll let the leaves, you know, kind of pile up in there. And I'll usually wait till December, end of December, early January, to then go through my beds. And, you know, of course, if I've got a rhododendron and the leaves are up to here, you know, those have to come out. But I always leave like 8 inches to a foot of leaves in all the beds. So now it's springtime. It's been warm. Bulbs are coming up. And as I see bulbs and my hellebores and perennials starting to emerge, I will start to pull away the leaves from the emerging clumps of perennials. But, you know, once they've, like your daylilies, once they've come up, then you leave the leaves around them and, you know, they've got their mulch all around them. So you don't have to add bark mulch to that. I've also found, the areas that we do mulch, if you wait till things emerge, you don't have to use as much mulch. So like your hostas, they come up and they, you know, they're this big, but all of a sudden they're 2.5-3 feet wide. So why mulch all the way up to those pips that are coming up? You know, just kind of spread the mulch where the leaves are gonna, the leaf spread is gonna end. So I'm going to switch topics a little here to hydrangeas. What I've learned, we've participated in the Cape Cod Hydrangea Festival for the last 5 years. What I've learned is that the blue mopheads, the classic blue hydrangeas, are the least hardy of all the hydrangeas. So they're the ones that, you know, they emerge in the spring with their buds, and then we get those 20 degree nights in April, and it's killed all the flower buds on the blue mopheads. Nothing you can do about it. You can't burlap them, you can't mulch them. There's just nothing you can do. Mother Nature is boss in that respect. But on the bright side, people are discovering the panicle hydrangeas, which are the cone-shaped ones. the limelights, the quick fires, beautiful creamy chartreuse colors on the flowers that change to rose, and they will bloom no matter what kind of winter we have. Same with the lace caps are a lot more forgiving than the blue moth heads. So I personally think the days of huge sweeps of hydrangeas are kind of done, because I mean, I could tell you the last 3 or 4 years, even for the hydrangea festival, it was like, are we gonna have any hydrangeas because of all this bud kill? So don't discount the panicles and the oak leaf hydrangeas and the lace caps. Any questions on hydrangeas? I always get a million questions.
The shooting star that you planted at Messiah,
yeah.
It seems to have wintered through. They're iffy, I understand. But will you be selling those this
year? Yeah. Just like with a lot of things the growers do, sometimes I think the breeders push out new varieties too quick before they've really been tested as to how they will perform with our weather. So, I mean, you see those tags and you see those flowers, you know, that come right from the breeders, and they're spectacular. I've been steering away from the macrophyllas, which are the mop head hydrangeas, because those are the least hardy. So the panic, we call them panics. Don't panic, they're gonna bloom. Those will bloom no matter what, and the colors on them are spectacular. And you know, the mop heads are blooming like late June into early July, when there's enough blooming in the garden. The panicles and the oak leaves start coming into their own in late July, August, into September and October. So for late season color, you just can't beat them. So now I'm going to go through some of the trends that that we've been seeing. Oh my gosh, it's already 1:20. Do I have an hour?
Sure.
Okay.
As long as you want.
So I'll just... these are some of the things we've been attending all kinds of seminars and lectures over the winter. So, more people are incorporating food into their landscapes. Mm-hmm. You know, the days of putting the vegetable garden in the back corner of the yard, you know, you forget about it out there. And you know, you're at your kitchen and you don't want to go all the way out to the backyard to pick some tomatoes or basil. So it's all about getting sort of the farm to table, it's your yard to table. And it's rethinking the victory garden. So I think vegetables in the landscape can be just as pretty as flowers. And those of you who have worked with me at Highfield, you know I love my lettuces in along the front border. I just think nothing is more beautiful and fresh in the spring than lettuce and pansies greeting you at the front door. So in the early spring, you can do lettuces, Swiss chard, rhubarb, kale. Again, it's not flowers, it's about texture and leaf color. In things like asparagus, you know, you should leave some asparagus to go to seed, and it's actually quite beautiful in the landscape. One of the best ideas I saw this winter was a border of basil and garlic. So, you know, basil is coming in all different kinds of shapes and leaf colors, but planting the garden, the garlic amongst your basil repels the rabbits and the deer. So that's a nice combination. The breeders have also come out with some really great bush tomatoes, bush peppers, bush eggplants. So for containers or along a walkway, you know, you don't have these big sprawling viney things, you know, that don't really look attractive in your garden. And then herbs like lavender and thyme, you know, those are beautiful. And to me, that's another part of the garden is scent. So, you know, to brush up against lavender or thyme as you're walking up to a front door. My favorite lavender is called Phenomenal. It came out about 5 years ago, and it's just amazing. It's just like the name. It is phenomenal. They get about 2.5 feet tall, about that wide. I think I've lost 3 in the last 5 years, and I've planted hundreds of them. And they bloom, you know, starting in late May, early June, and I've had them bloom all the way through to the end of July. So it's a great little plant. Outdoor living rooms, bringing the inside out. Everybody wants fire pits. You know, it's just another way to bring people outside, get off of their phones, away from the TV, and sit outside. They're creating, well, I thought this was cute, Zen dens. So, you know, again, it's all about creating a space outside that people are comfortable in and draw you out. And I thought this was an interesting statistic. 120 minutes a week or 17 minutes a day in the garden is shown to increase your well-being. So after work, everybody's got a chance to just stroll outside, deadhead a few things, and, you know, just connect with nature at the end of the day. Outdoor kitchens and dining rooms are huge. To me, it's almost a little like over the top. Some of the kitchens that we've seen, it's fun and amazing, but you know, it's almost like a second kitchen, you know, outside. I think that's fine in California, where you can be outside for, you know, 7-9 months out of the year. But here, to have that for this short window, I mean, if you can afford it, awesome. The other thing that we're seeing is this resurgence in houseplants. What goes around comes around. I started gardening when I was 16, with my macrame hangers and slide plants and, you know, our little plants in the windowsills. And now, I said, man, is this making me feel old? You know, it's just come back full circle. And, you know, our industry is really trying to encourage the next generation of gardeners. So the millennials, they don't want to grow food, they don't want to grow ornamentals in the garden. They want to grow food and houseplants. It's just really funny, you know, where their brains are. But I think that leads them to wanting to grow more and more flowers. They call themselves plant parents. But they are really into their food, so that's kind of cool. And getting kids interested in gardening also, I think, is really important. Just to, you know, that their food just doesn't come out of a can or from the grocery store. And I have seen it with my own granddaughters that, oh, I'm not going to eat a tomato, but they helped me grow these little cherry tomatoes and the lettuce, and they were eating salads that they grew. So it can happen. Some landscape trends. Dwarf shrubs are being used a lot now instead of higher maintenance perennials. I think the days of the big, long, you know, English sweeping borders of perennials, unless you have an army of gardeners that can help you with that, I think those days are done. So dwarf shrubs, you don't have to divide them, you don't have to really cut them back. But they read like perennials in the garden. less is more. We're using simpler plant palettes. Designers are usually using simpler plant palettes. That being said, if I see a new plant that I want, you know, I've always got a little spot in my garden to tuck things away. Let's talk about color of the year. So every year I anxiously await for the Pantone color of the year. And I like it because it makes me want to use a different color palette than I normally wouldn't use. So last year was this coral color that I really had a hard time wrapping my head around. But I ended up using coral and pink and orange impatiens, the New Guinea impatiens, in my backyard planting, and it was spectacular. So don't be afraid to think outside the color box. This year the color is classic blue, and everything blue. I love blue. Blue, purple, yellow, and then at the nursery we call them the pink, blue, white ladies. You know, they want the classic pink, blue, white flowers. That is a classic combination. But blue, yellow, and oranges or blue, orange, and silver is a really cool, a very elegant color combination for containers. So if you hadn't thought of using that. The Perennial Plant Association plant of the year is Aralia Sun King. Aralias, they almost look like a bamboo, but they're not. They have larger foliage, but they sort of grow in clumps like that. What I love about Sun King is, well, it gets like 4x4, so it's a sturdy plant, but it has this glowing chartreuse foliage. So in a shade garden, it takes part shade or shade, you know, to have that burst of color of chartreuse, it can really brighten up a shade garden. Proven winners, annual of the year, are the diamond euphorbias. If you haven't tried those and you have a full sun, hot deck or patio area, they look like little baby's breath, but much, much hardier. Their perennial of the year is Russian sage, but denim lace. The first Russian sages that came out, you know, they get tall, they get lanky, they kind of flop all over the place. But denim lace gets to be like the size of a daylily, and they bloom in August and September. Nice blue color. And the proven winner shrub of the year is Ilex Gem Box. It's what we are looking towards as an alternative to boxwood. We've knocked on wood. I think there's been one case of boxwood blight here on the Cape, but Virginia has been decimated by boxwood blight. So Ilex Gem Box, it's a dwarf version of Inkberry. And it's nice and full, it stays full to the bottom, and gets to about 2 to 3 feet high. And I'm going to end with this, last but not least, because I never thought I would be talking about this, is cannabis. So I cannot tell you, when I did CL's show, she said, Terry, I'm getting more questions about cannabis than hydrangeas. So 3 years ago when it was legalized, you know, we had this discussion. Well, you know, how do we handle this? Because we were getting questions coming in. So we use Coast of Maine products. And, you know, all their products are named after different towns in Maine. So they came out with Stonington Blend, and it was formulated specifically for growing cannabis. And I actually went to one of CL's talks a couple of weeks ago because, you know, this is a new crop. That's how I'm looking at it. It's a crop. I have to tell people how to grow it. And she had great information about it. And there was 75 people there. It was sold out. She's had to add 3 more sessions on it. Everybody there except maybe 3 people were over 60. So I just thought it was really funny. So you never know in the plant world, but that's what I love about gardening is that every year there's something new, wow, and you learn something new. So thank you all for coming today. This is the new proven winners idea book, and then we also have postcards with a 30% off coupon for the nursery. And if you don't get our newsletter, it's very informative. Marcia, our nursery manager, actually writes it. She's a really good writer. So if you'd like to receive that, you can sign up for that as well. And I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Your idea about food and edible landscaping.
Yeah.
I tell people, don't bother with an orchard because you end up spraying everything else. But there are so many good berries.
Yeah.
There's a thornless blackberry. It's so prolific. You don't have to spray it or anything else.
Yeah.
And you get a lot of food.
And blueberries. Blueberries are a beautiful landscape plant. You know, you get the flowers in the spring, the berries in the summer, and then they turn a beautiful apricot color in the fall. And they, again, have come out with nice dwarf varieties that you can use.
Thank you, Terry. Oops, you can come over and have a little bit of seltzer and keep talking.
I just want to say hi.